Welcome to the Lexington Public Library's Tales from the Kentucky Room podcast, where we discuss everything Lexington and Fayette County history. I'm Miriam, and in each episode of this podcast, we will feature a guest that will share a piece of local history. So thank you for tuning in and enjoy. In previous episodes of the podcast, we discussed a few of the Black enclaves that were historic neighborhoods housing a predominantly African-American population. On today's episode, we welcome my colleague, J.P. Johnson, to help us delve deeper into the Prawl Town neighborhood. This development was established by and named after John A. Prawl from Woodford County, who subsequently moved to Lexington where he practiced law. This neighborhood's rich history is often misrepresented and is in its geographic location would have implication to the current growth of the University of Kentucky campus. Many of the residents stamp their place in Lexington history. So let us get into the tale with J.P. Johnson, librarian at the Central Library. Hi, J.P.
Hi, Miriam.
How are you? Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you've been doing a lot of research around Prawl Town, the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Of course, we wanted to have you on the podcast to share the research with our listeners. So give us a little bit of background on how Prawl Town.
Prawl Town was originally established in about 1868. It was first bought by a trio of men who then sold it to other people. So Prawl Town consists of land around and including McMullen, Prawl, and Colfax Streets, which are off of Nicholasville Road, or at that point it's South Limestone. And so John Andrew Prawl bought 36 lots. He bought 5 acres in December 1868, and Prawl Street was the principal street of that section. Frederick McMullen bought 10 acres, and McMullen was the principal street for that section. And then Willard Davis, who was the founder of Davis Bottom, bought 43 lots in and around Colfax Street. There isn't any research why they settled on Prawl being the name of it, other than he also, John Prawl, also owned land adjacent to the properties where he lived when he lived in Lexington. And that area is now the Bosworth Hall, what used to be the Lexington Seminary.
Mm. Okay, for at the University of Kentucky.
Yes.
Yeah. So give us, again, some background on John Andrew Prawl. He was a pro-union person, and but also owned slaves.
Yes. So John Prawl, very common for the time for to be both pro-union and owning slaves. He was a Bourbon County, Kentucky senator. He was a pro-union supporter, a slave owner, but he opposed. He was one of two senators in Kentucky who opposed black men enlisting as union soldiers. He thought that it would upset white soldiers and push people away from the pro-union cause. So in 1860, in what was called the United States Slave Schedule, he owned 8 enslaved people in Bourbon County. He then, after the Civil War in 1868, he moved to Lexington to practice law. I haven't found any, either in Renette Jones's paper that she wrote for the Notable Kentuckian African Americans website, or in just my own research, I haven't found why, but by 1877, the area was known as Prawl Town.
Okay.
So originally in 1867, 3 men, John Davis, James Perkins, and Peter Johnson, bought land in that area. That partnership was dissolved when James Perkins purchased 10 of the 18 acres. From that point, Frederick McMullen bought land, James Prawl bought land, then Willard Davis, but nothing shows why they chose Prawl, except for possibly the fact Willard Davis being the founder of Davis Bottom, there was already a place called Davis. But that doesn't explain why not McMullen Town or something else.
So take us through the Civil War, post-Civil War, and then once African-Americans started to move into the area.
So after the Civil War, African-Americans tended to move in the South to urban areas. And they were basically looking for what any of us look for, seeking jobs, education, safety, an overall better way of life. So during that time, post-Civil War, you have the starting of enclaves like Kincaid Town, Goodloe Town, Prawl Town, and these were all areas that were owned by white wealthy landowners who then started selling and mortgaging out lots and half lots to the new black residents. And mortgaging the lots made sure that, whereas before the Civil War, white wealthy landowners were benefiting from unpaid slave labor, after the Civil War, they would be benefiting from the paid mortgages, the rents on the property that the new black citizens would have to make for the property. So all these enclaves were around less desirable areas of the city, near factories, warehouses, bottom land, near train tracks, like Pearltown is between what was at the time called Nicholasville Pike and the Kentucky Southern Railroad, which is now like Norfolk Southern Railroad. And it was considered bottom land. It was not valuable. And so it was the best thing to do would be to sell it off.
Okay. Can you explain to our listeners what bottom land is?
Bottom land would be low-lying areas that would be easily flooded.
Yeah, during rains and...
Yeah, which I'm trying to, when I visualize the property, though, it's very hilly. But there's a picture of a lake in front of what is the main administration building at UK. So I say that whole area before they drained it and built the road was probably very prone to flooding.
Yeah, probably turned into some sort of swamp or area or whatever. During this big move, it was predominantly African-American, but there was also some white landowners. Can you talk to maybe the reaction of the white landowners that were in the area? Did they live together normally, or how?
Well, there were some immigrants who moved into the area, but generally, regardless of whether the land was sold to newly free black people or mortgaged to them, the white community was against having to live with other black people. One of the things that Renette Jones said in her paper was that at least they were kind of isolated in 12 areas in the city, 12 enclaves. But still, the city and eventually the University of Kentucky would be really interested in destroying Pearltown and allowing UK to expand. And there were things in place federally that would allow that even though the Pearltown community wanted to maintain its position in the city and take care of its property, federally there was redlining, there was the desire to remove slums and urban renewal that would come to play in allowing UK to expand. And urban renewal sounds kind of like a good idea, but really it was just an attempt of destroying these neighborhoods that had a majority black population.
Yeah. And this was discussed in the exhibition that we had a few months ago here in terms of redlining in Lexington.
Well, I was really interested in that because the paper that Renette wrote, she mentions that the city at least had said that they were interested in getting funds to help people maintain their properties. And that's where I'm like, well, federally, that probably wouldn't have happened because even if you, whether they knew that or not, the money was not going to be given to these neighborhoods. And someone in an article said that a lot of our urban renewal was through attrition, where we just leave properties alone until they fall apart. And then
there was no investment in it. What about the people that lived in that neighborhood in Pearltown? I know that there's several prominent members of that community. You know, they were tradesmen, very skilled workers. At one point, it was a thriving neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Pearltown really, really hit its stride in the early 1900s in the 20th century. So in 1907, there were approximately 137 lots with about 143 homes. Sellers Alley had been added to the back end of the property so that people could stay within Pearltown without having to get out onto Nicholasville Pike. At that time, in 1900, there were four jockeys that lived in Pearltown: Frank Buckner Jr., Elijah Nero, Horace Wells, and Price Davis. There were laundresses, servants, railroad employees, cooks, and day laborers, porters, bricklayers, ministers, shoemakers, and barbers. And it was really its own. One of the things I've noticed about the black enclaves is that they're really self-sufficient and self-contained within their borders. Pleasant Green Church was there, which Pleasant Green was an area just to the west of between Pearltown and Davis Bottom. And of course, one of the thing that most attracted me to Pearltown is James Herndon, Sweet Evening Breeze, who lived on Pearl Street and is actually currently one of two, I don't know if they're original, but Sweet Evening Breeze's house is still on Pearl Street. And there's another house across the street and closer to Nicholasville that is an older house, while the rest of it seems to have been taken over by UK student housing or just apartment buildings that have UK students in it. James Herndon was born in Scott County in 1892. He came to Lexington by 1920 and moved into the house that would become his home for the rest of his life at 186 Prawl Street. Through his church, he became involved with both Lexington's music community, but also a popular community ritual that he would call rainbow weddings, all-male wedding ceremonies performed to raise money for the church or other organizations. In 1945, the Lexington newspaper ran an ad for one of these weddings with a picture of Herndon in full white wedding gown. As far as I'm aware, it's not clear when James Herndon garnered the name of Sweet Evening Breeze, but that warm breeze began blowing through Lexington early on. There are two Lexingtons, the Lexington that knows James Herndon as the orderly at Good Samaritan Hospital, and the Lexington that knows James Herndon for dressing as he pleased, in women's clothing, gloves, and bobbed wig, and walking to and from Lexington's downtown core. However, the overlap of these two Lexingtons is quite large. More recently, thanks to the popularity of such shows as RuPaul's Drag Race and Pose, and the increasing popularity of the ballroom scene, Sweets has been dubbed Lexington's mother of us all. At the intersection of blackness and queerness, a queer icon given her due as not only a leader in the Lexington's gay community, but a Prawl town. Herndon's house is one of a few houses that still stand on Prawl Street, surrounded by new student housing. Sweets died in 1983, though his memory lives on through the stories of Lexington's residents. In remembering Tony Briggs, a friend of his, Avery Buckman, remembers Sweets. We, Briggs and Buckman, bonded over Sweet Evening Breeze. He'd been his neighbor on Prawl Street. Sweets had been my great aunt's right-hand assistant at Good Sam and my fave person as a young child. I can still remember cuddling in his lap. Sweets is featured in Jean Donahue's documentary, The Last Gospel of the Pagan Babies. That's her on the poster. More recently, Sweets has been memorialized with a mural on the north side of 161 North Limestone, what is currently Georgie's Social House. The mural is by Boston-based artist Gaia and is part of Lexington's Prohibition series of community art. A.B. Guthrie wrote about Sweets in his autobiography, The Blue Hen's Chick. And I wanted to read this little bit. So the best known personage in the bluegrass was not, and to date is not, a statesman or a politician or owner of a horse farm or a collector and singer of ancient ballads like John Jacob Niles or a historian and author like my old friend and neighbor, Dr. Thomas D. Clark, who broke from the wicker of Mississippi's cotton and cane and struck in a bushel light. It wasn't even Happy Chandler who set out to win national prominence with no more than a red sweater and a $5 bill. It was a black man, a hospital orderly, James Herndon by name, whom most people knew as Sweet Evening Breeze. Hospital folk, those in position to measure his talents, rated James the best of all orderlies. No one else could administer so artful an enema. When learners bungled the job, he was quick to inform and correct them. With the contents of the bag transmitted to the receiver, he slowed the imperative peristalsis with philosophical musings. All other tasks that fell to an orderly he performed with like competence. His small house, which he himself kept, was immaculate, said those who knew, and furnished tastefully with antiques. He was known as an excellent cook, of pastries particularly, but not even the sum of these virtues accounted for his fame. James was effeminate in movement, response, and to a degree dress. His voice was light, his walk short-stepped and mannered. He liked to groom himself and in public to appear in clean press hospital whites. Once he was the featured performer, as reported in colored notes, in a Negro extravaganza. Lowered in a basket from the ceiling of Woodland Auditorium, decked out in feminine frills, he danced the passion dance of the Bongo Bangos. I regret that I didn't see it. No one questioned the inspired appropriateness of this nickname, though no one knew its origin, but everyone knew Sweet Evening Breeze, including outsiders with only a casual acquaintance with Lexington. It came to pass, by the sworn word of witnesses, that in the days of Dud Veal as city detective, James was brought to the station house for an offense imagined or real. One of Dud's fellow sleuths was Joe Harrigan, who was a shade the more literate. Dud took the arrest blotter and laboriously began making the entry. Then he looked up at Harrigan. "I don't know what to book him for," he said. Harrigan chewed on a cigar and sized up James. "Book him," he said, "for being a goddamn proverb."
Well, the point is that it was a very diverse and very vibrant community.
Yeah.
With all kinds of characters and people with different backgrounds. And so it's important to point out that history.
So Renette is the first person to actually say that Sweet Evening Breeze was sort of a community leader. Like, I feel like in our discussions of sweets on the podcast and in general, we kind of lean towards that, but it's always sort of like, we never just out say like, this person is a leader of the community, because not only was he, you know, a leader of the queer community and a very visually incongruous part of the Lexington community, he was doing a lot in Prawl Town. Like in The Last Gospel of the Pagan Babies, Tony Briggs talks about, you know, all the rich white people who would come to the Prawl Town to have parties at Sweet Evening Breezes. But when those white people weren't there, Sweets was still reaching out to community members, you know, taking a cake to people who were sick, giving money to people who needed it. The park that is next to Sweeting and Breeze's house, I think, might have been, Sweets may have been responsible for it. There's a story about Sweets having a house torn down next to him because the neighbors were too loud. And there's this park that is named by another Prawl Town celebrity that I think also includes like Sweets's backyard. But yeah, it's just
he was a connection, a mm-hmm. social connection between neighbors and dang. Now towards what is considered the second Great Migration, mm-hmm. things start to change for Prawl Town.
Yeah, during the second Great Migration, I think like the population of Black people in Kentucky lowered, but it still increased a little bit in Lexington. But at that time, we had Jim Crow became much more enforced during that time. The systems of redlining were very much in place. Money was not going into these Black enclaves. So people were leaving the area for even better
living conditions, basically. Yeah. So even though they were self-sufficient and such, there was no federal, state, or local tax monies spent on paving roads and upkeep of sidewalks, et cetera.
Yeah. So but still there were Black people coming from further south into Lexington. The old train depot was across basically what is now South Broadway from Prawl Town. And Black people coming into Lexington somehow found out that if they went to Prawl Town, they would be given place to stay, given food, given shelter. So there was still that attempt of community.
Yeah.
The community worked well within the confines it was put in by the white majority of the city. And it was really at that point that both, you know, the city was already kind of putting pressure on these Black enclaves because there was a slum committee that was going around wanting to, like, not so much provide better housing, but move people into other areas of the city. That's when, like, Charlotte Court first started. They wanted all the Black communities to be living in these public housing kind of situations. And the slum committee was really working in the University of Kentucky's favor because the university wanted to expand. And the easiest way to expand were these places that were already, whenever they were discussed, they were not considered not communities, but slums.
Yeah. And once they are become considered slums, then they could easily be condemned by the city.
Right.
And therefore, sold at a very
and this price came
to the university.
Yeah. And this came to a head in 1953 when they really tried to push for expanding the UK into Prawl Town. And the community came together and pushed back against the slum committees and urban renewal. And Prawl Town was really considered a failure of urban renewal because they didn't get to kick people out. Like the community came together and were like, you're not telling us where you're going to put us or what kind of housing there's going to be. And they really pushed back. And that I find amazing. So in the 60s, Prawl Town was considered a failure of urban renewal, even though in the 60s also the urban renewal sort of machine started picking apart other places in town. And in the 60s, in 69, UK said that they were going to get rid of their Prawl Town property. They had bought some property there and like they created a parking lot. And I think they were going to extend the College of Education into Prawl Town. And there is some of that, I think, there. But in 69, they said that they were going to divest of that because there was such a pushback from the community that they wanted to try to help to save Prawl Town.
Yeah.
Didn't work very well.
Yeah.
Burnett calls it the dismantling of Prawl Town. And it really started probably in the 30s and just kept piece by piece being picked apart until now, like I said, on Prawl Town itself, there's two old houses. I haven't been as much on McMullen and Colfax, but I feel like, you know, all to my knowledge, all the housing there is rentals. And that's really kind of, you know, we see the same thing in the East End, where there are original houses there, but they're all rentals. They're all owned by our current day John Prawls and Frederick McMullins, who benefit from rents and mortgages and things like that.
We probably should have done this at the beginning, but give us a geographical, like, just approximation of where Prawl Town is as to current day, so that our listeners can understand where it is exactly.
Okay, so Prawl Town is the area that is called Prawl Town, is across the street from Memorial Hall. So it's three streets that run perpendicular to Nicholas Road, South Limestone, and the railway is still there between Nicholasville Road and South Broadway, and it's directly across the street from Memorial Hall.
Then across, there's the education building.
Yeah. Where Scott Street is.
Where it like splits, mm-hmm. Where the split is.
Yeah, but it's on, so if you're going out Nicholasville Road, it's on the right. There's three streets, Colfax, McMullen, and Prawl Town, and most people probably know the Prawl Street intersection because there's a light there in Memorial Hall across the way. I was thinking of Memorial Coliseum because in reading about this, I was reading some about Adamstown, about UK's push to destroy Adamstown so they could build Memorial Coliseum. And then within a decade or two, the city decides to build Rupp Arena.
Yeah.
And so there's typically this push to destroy Black enclaves with really no like long-term view of anything. So in talking about Adamstown, this references an article by Tom Eblin, and it was just like, Adamstown was a predominantly Black neighborhood that both private landowners and the university had long sought to displace in favor of higher and better uses. And that's something that you see in the discussion of redlining in general, is that there's this push to for a cleaner city, for that the slums are full of diseases and crime, and really it's just typically Black people living their own lives. And
well, they got that way because there is no investment in those. And it's not because of the residents, it's because of the lack of investment from the city.
Yeah.
What is the status of Prawl Town now? Is there like a historical marker to mark the area, or?
No. The only thing that really marks the area, there's not even like Sweet Emily Breeze's house is occupied. I think it's a rental, but there is a park there. It's Lou Johnson Park. Lou Johnson is another famous Prawl Town person. He was the first Black man from Lexington to play in a Major League Baseball team. Yeah. And the park there was named after him. It was originally just the Prawl Town Park. Probably after Sweet Emily Breeze, the next most famous person from nationally from Prawl Town is Lou Johnson. Louis Brown Johnson was the first African-American from Lexington to play Major League Baseball. In 8 years in the majors, Sweet Lou had a career average of .258 with 48 home runs. But he achieved lasting greatness in 1965 when he starred for the Dodgers in the World Series. In a seven-game series against the Minnesota Twins, the left fielder hit .296 with two home runs and two doubles. His fourth-inning homer off Jim Catt in Game 7 was the only run Sandy Koufax needed in a 2-0 Dodgers win. Born in Prawl Town, Johnson attended the old Dunbar High School. He played for the semi-pro Lexington Hustlers and minor league Lexington Colts. He made it to the majors in 1960s with the Cubs after a stint with the Negro League team, the Indianapolis Clowns. Johnson was honored first in 1978 with the naming of a park in Prawl Town, Lou Johnson Park. Then in 1998, the city named a T-ball league after Johnson. And finally in 2004, the city dedicated a street adjacent to Prawl Town and about 100 feet from Johnson's childhood home as Lou Johnson Way. The ceremony was attended by members of Johnson's family, including his then 101-year-old mother, Sidney Johnson, as well as Prawl Town residents and representatives of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Sweet Lou helped shape the dreams of an entire generation, said then-Mayor Teresa Isaac, who dedicated the street. He died in 2020, and I think it was, at the time, the park was kind of seen as the example park that all the other parks were supposed to be based on, but unless you drive down Pearl Street, you don't know there's a park there.
There's so, no marker.
There's no marker, nothing.
Yeah.
At least the Pearl Street part of Pearl Town, like I said, has been taken over by all new apartments. And when the Faulkner Morgan archives started, one of the first things I did was to go see if Sweet Evening Breeze's house was still there, because no one actually knew, because no one had driven down the street for looking for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, and I don't think there's like a move to put a marker there based on like there are people who live in that house and that draw attention to they probably would not want.
You don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Well, it's very fascinating. There's so many African American enclaves in the city that deserve to be documented. I know that Pearl Town tends to be considered one of the first. There were several, of course, that were developed before it, but it is one of the more left its mark on Lexington history. Mm-hmm. And it's important for us to remember that, even though there is no marker to mark that area, unfortunately. But hopefully that'll change soon. So.
Yeah, and it was important not just to the Black community. A lot of the enclaves, because downtown itself was the core downtown, was being kind of ignored during urban renewal or destroyed. A lot of the Black enclaves are important to sort of your alt-left kind of white community as well. There was the Pearl Town Cafe, that there were bands that played there. And in the 80s, that was sort of the center of the punk scene, because during the day, it would just be a regular cafe. But at night, bands like the Veil of Tears, that was headed by Tony Briggs, who was a Pearl Town resident, would go and play punk music. And you'd have all these punks just kind of dancing, and and that's something that has happened as long as an area is being sort of ignored by the reputable Lexingtonians. A lot of wonderful things kind of happened in downtown Lexington that don't really happen as much anymore.
Well, it kind of speaks to the area, maybe the neighborhood itself, the people, the residents were, again, diverse.
Mm-hmm. And more accepting.
More accepting.
When I met Tony Briggs, he was the owner of Ye Olde Bookshop next to what is now the Fish Tank at the corner of Euclid and Woodland Avenues. My partner at the time and I would go there to look for rare music magazines featuring artists that we were into at the time. Briggs brought music to the lives of a lot of people in Lexington. Tony was born in Pearl Town and was a neighbor of Sweet Evening Breeze. As lead singer of the 80s punk band Veil of Tears, Tony brought punk music to Pearl Town, with different bands performing at the Pearl Town Cafe. In 1983, Todd Fleffman wrote about how the Pearl Town Cafe was quiet during the week. But come the week, the quiet little establishment, nestled snugly and almost unnoticeably among the small, narrow houses on Pearl Street, undergoes a transformation, becoming the hangout for Lexington's new music scene. It is then that the color, fashion, and sound of the local new music crowd overruns the usually empty structure and fills it with an aura more like a modern big city night spot than a neighborhood cafe. Most of, quote, them, unquote, turn out decked in a wide array of punk chic. Black leather, spiky wristbands, mini skirts, fishnet stockings, heavily painted faces, and lopsided hairdos. The punk scene came to Pearl Town on May 26, 1983, when Briggs's Veil of Tears and the Plastic Fangs first descended on the cafe. The gigs were arranged by Briggs, who grew up right around the corner from the cafe. Describing the reaction of longtime Pearl Town residents to the scene, Fleffman writes, "Even 90-year-old Marcus Wilson, a toothless old gentleman wearing a beat-up brown fedora and taped-up black-framed spectacles, his foot lightly tapping to the music, can be found making the scene most weekends. I've been here when there wasn't no music, and I've been here when there was music," said Wilson, taking time out from his cigar and beer. "I like the music, and that's why I'm here now." In 2020, a Herald Leader contributor wrote, "To call Briggs an enthusiast of his craft misses the point. When he was on stage during the punk heyday of Veil of Tears, he lived the music he performed. He inhabited its drive, fury, and vision. Off stage, however, Briggs was completely disarming. His demeanor was gracious and upbeat to the point of being enlightened. Admittedly, Briggs could be very plain speaking, but that never translated into behavior that was coarse or off-putting." Charles Fegan wrote this about Tony Briggs when Tony died in 2020. "It was in the early 1980s, and I had just started listening to some punk music after reading a glowing review of The Clash's London Calling. I was working a summer job in Lexington, spending a lot of time at Cut Corner and Bears Wax Records. To make a little extra money, I also donated plasma twice a week. One day, while I was at the Plasma Center and wearing buttons for some punk bands, probably The Clash, X, Talking Heads, Tony Briggs saw the buttons and started talking to me about music. He invited me over to his house and fixed me a bacon cheeseburger and told me about this new club in town. He gave me some homemade independent music magazines and told me about a band playing there soon. I met him at Club Agogo for my first punk concert, DOA, a hardcore band from Canada. It was an amazing show. My ears were ringing for several days afterwards. I made frequent trips back to the club and heard many great bands. It was there that I first heard Jason and the Scorchers playing their first show outside of Nashville. It was there and at various other clubs that I followed. Jefferson Davis Inn, Prawltown Cafe, Cafe LMNOP, Rockledge, that I saw many great bands and met many wonderful people that I'm honored to call friends. Throughout all the different clubs and different local bands on the scene and touring bands that came through Lexington, Tony was always around when there was hard rocking music to be heard. I later discovered that he had been instrumental in bringing a lot of out-of-town bands into Lexington and developing the local music scene, including being the lead singer in several bands himself. And as loud and hard-rocking as his music was when he was in a band, in person, he was as kind and generous as anyone I've ever met. He was going to be presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Lexington Music Awards on January 26. So much of the music I've listened to over the past 40 years and so many of the people I've met, I never would have known had I not met Tony. Thank you for so many great experiences and memories. Godspeed, my friend. On January 26, 2020, just 8 days after he died, Brix was recognized for his lifetime achievement by the Lexington Music Awards. He was a figurehead of the local rock community with a performance history of over 3.5 decades. An interview with Briggs and footage of him performing in Lexington with the Veil of Tears can be seen in Gene Donahue's documentary on queer Lexington history, The Last Gospel of the Pagan Babies.
Thank you so much, JP, for joining us on the podcast. We appreciate all the research you put in. We hope you come visit us again on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Tales from the Kentucky Room, a podcast brought to you by the Central Library's Kentucky Room staff at the Lexington Public Library. If you enjoyed listening, please take a minute to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you have any questions about local history or genealogy research, you can visit us in the Kentucky Room to use our collection and newspaper microfilm, or you can email us at elibrarian@lexpublib.org. That's elibrarian@lexpublib.org. I'm Miriam, and we'll be back with another trip down Lexington's memory lane.